Good evening. We're going to continue our lesson from Sunday, because I think technically we didn't get past question one on Sunday. So we have two through six to get through today. But I appreciated the discussion on Sunday. While it wasn't necessarily what we had planned, was definitely a very practical question for us to think about. And hopefully you all were able to go home and think about why we partake of the Lord's Supper and then its impact on who should take it, and really then give you something to reflect on as we as you do partake of the Lord's Supper. I do want to start out actually looking at that, but before... So what spurred the conversation on Sunday was looking at the similarities and differences of the Lord's Supper and the Passover, and specifically came up, kids partook of the Passover, why don't kids partake of the Lord's Supper? And so we went and we talked through that. We allowed people to give some opinions, some scriptures, and look at that particular instance. But the thing for me coming back to this, and this is kind of wrapping up that question, it's a third bullet point on question one: how does the Lord's Supper relate to the Passover? There's also a second half of that: how is it different than the Passover? And that's the first point I want to bring out, is when we're looking at this, there's not a one-to-one correlation between the Passover and the Lord's Supper. And so while it might seem, well, I mean, Jesus is the Passover lamb and the Passover was celebrated this way, that doesn't mean that we're taking the rites and the rituals of the Passover and bringing them over and applying them into the Lord's Supper. And it was a shadow and a type for us to understand what Jesus' purpose was. But the celebration that we have of the Lord's Supper, the memorial, is a different thing. And so pulling and trying to bind things or find correlations between how it was observed isn't going to hold up as we transition between the two. And then the second thing really comes out of the similarities of what was the purpose of the Passover and what was the purpose of the Lord's Supper. And there's a similarity in the purpose between the two. And for me, this is one of the big things to focus on. And I think what helps answer this question of who should take the Lord's Supper. So when we look at the Passover, part of the thing for the Israelites to remember was their freedom from the Egyptians. So it says, this is the day that the Lord brought you by night out of Egypt. You were freed from your slavery. We have the same correlation with the Lord's Supper. We are freed from our sin through the sacrifice of Christ. Now for the Israelites, that happened once. That freedom happened as they were pulled up out of Egypt, and they were now God's people to inherit the land. And that freedom from the slavery of Egypt happened, and it happened for all of Israel at that one time. The difference with the Lord's Supper is our freedom from sin is available to all through Christ, but each individual person makes that commitment on their own, and then at that point has the memorial to remember the freedom they received through Christ. And so we have this different point of application between those two memorials, but the remembrance of our freedom. And so that is, to me, that's a big one to remember with these memorials, is that freedom from slavery, the freedom from sin, and the freedom to be one of God's people, one of his children. Anyone have any comments before we move off of Passover and start looking at the other feasts? Think.
Well, Passover was done by households. That's a big difference. And I think also, too, with children are already saved, you know, until they hit that age of accountability. So I don't think that they are, you know, I mean, until they get to that point, you know, they are saved.
Yeah, so you can look at that as they're saved, or they haven't committed a transgression that makes them guilty then of penalty. And so that's what we would traditionally call the age of accountability. I was shocked when I couldn't actually find the term age of accountability in my Bible. I was like, wait, where did this come from? But it's simply stating the time in which you can determine right from wrong. And then at that point, right, you can live in rebellion to God, or you can live in subjection to God's will and making that choice. And so with that, right, the difference in here being that as children, there is no submission to God's will, because there's also no rebellion from it. And the freedom that we have from that sin comes from the fact when we live in rebellion to God and then make a choice to come back to him, and then that memorial has a purpose in our life. Steve?
I just would like to say, when you're talking about this age of accountability, even a little child knows right from wrong. It's more than knowing right from wrong. A small child, 5 years old, knows not to hit his little sister. You know, they know right from wrong at a quite early age, but they may not have an understanding of Christ being the Son of God and sacrificing himself on the cross for the sins of the world. And so there's that understanding, which takes an older child that may realize that, you know, the difference between right and wrong. So that's something that is an important consideration.
Absolutely. That's, I think that's one of the points we actually see with the covenant as well, right? It's a covenant relationship in the Old Testament between God and his people. It's a covenant relationship now between us and God through Jesus. And there has to be the competency of mind to enter into that covenant with God. Just like you don't allow the children to get married because they don't understand the ramifications of making a lifelong commitment. It's the same thing that we have with Christ. We're making a lifelong commitment to live in subjection to his will and not our own. And that's something that takes, as you said, Steve, a little bit more mature mind to understand. So as we move through then into Deuteronomy 16 a little bit further, we've got some additional feasts. And the first one is the Feast of... Not what's in the questions, because we're not going to go in order of the questions. The Feast of Unleavened Bread. What is the Feast of Unleavened Bread? Jerry?
It was the basically the week of the Passover. It included the day when they would actually eat the Passover lamb. But it was 7 days when they would eat only unleavened bread. And there's the command about nothing leavened shall be found among them when it will be cut off from their people. Which also, I think, when we understand the feast of unleavened bread as part of the overall Passover observance, and the fact that the terms are sometimes blended, it also helps alleviate some of the confusion in John about the Pharisees still not having eaten the Passover after they had delivered Jesus over to Pilate.
Right, or that was one of the ones that, as I'm reading through the New Testament references, it says, on the first day of unleavened bread, Jesus told his disciples to go and find a place to observe Passover. And you're sitting there going, wait a second, unleavened bread is supposed to come after Passover. Like, what am I supposed to do with this? But the two festivals are often referred to by just the term Passover, which includes both the Passover itself and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so, as Jerry said, we've got 7 days of unleavened bread. What does this represent? What was the purpose of this feast? So the Passover was the lamb itself, right, representing the cost of leaving Egypt and the requirement of the Lord passing over them as well as redeeming them. What was unleavened bread all about? What's so bad about yeast?
Well, it kind of goes back to the beginning. Unleavened bread started because they were going to leave Egypt in a hurry. So that was how it started. What it came to mean was sin. So you're cleansing your house of sin for this whole week of festival. So, again, it was a precursor for Passover and getting ready to leave Egypt. But then it later became you're cleaning your house out, ready to observe Passover, cleaning it of sin, if you will. That's what the leaven stood for in your house.
And so it comes back, its originating text comes all the way back to right with Passover, which is why these festivals or the feasts are right next to each other, because the events themselves happen right next to each other. And so we've got the removal of the leaven. I like that you brought that forward to what we also see with 1 Corinthians, our New Testament correlation here, of removing the leaven. And then it says the malice and the hatred, right, the sin that's in your life, removing that out of the household and starting then fresh. Which corresponds with what month was Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread taken in? First, right? You might see Nisan or Nisan. I tend to go towards the car, play to Nisan. Or Aviv, right, if you're looking in the Hebrew. That's going to be the first month. So you're starting the year out, remembering the freedom you have and removing the impurities out, which if, I don't know if this is actually within the correlation here, right, but if how you actually get yeast, is it's airborne and it collects in the dough as the dough sits out. And so you're taking that and removing your dough essentially from your house and starting with a fresh batch of dough, starting the year out fresh in your house. And so then that lasts for 7 days. Anything special with the first and the last day of this particular festival? Or Sabbaths. Right? So you've got the first day and the last day are Sabbath days to the Lord, which also help us correspond and understand the timeline with Jesus' death. And so understanding that Sabbaths just didn't happen only on Fridays, but Sabbaths were also corresponded with the festivals that went on during that time. And so we see here with this Feast of Unleavened Bread that from the 15th day to the 21st day, you've got no leaven in your house. You've got this holy convocation or Sabbath unto the Lord with no work being done, and which also goes with Passover. You were supposed to prepare only the meal that you were supposed to have. And so this takes away all the distractions out of their life. And if you also think about this moving forward, Deuteronomy 16, we see 16:16, a little bit further, we see that the males are supposed to be the ones going down. There's a preparation that happens with these feasts. The males are supposed to end up in Jerusalem. Traveling is not something they're supposed to be doing on the Sabbath. The preparing of their meal is not something they're supposed to be doing on the Sabbath. And so they have to take the time out to actually go and come down to Jerusalem for this feast. And then at home, I would assume, I tried to do a little research to see if I could find anything. If anyone has anything on this, let me know. What did the women and children do during those times? It doesn't say that they could not come down with them, but the obligation was for the males to come down there. I would assume that without the male there as well, that things changed around the house, and the house was supposed to be clear of the leaven, so there'd also be an observance as well, but I was not able to find anything on that. Does anyone have any information on what the non-males did during that time? I guess that just includes females, but children, I guess, were in there as well. Mike?
Well, we do have the example of Jesus going down as a child, and we have examples of Mary going with Joseph. So I don't think it was prohibited, but I think it just was whatever you could afford. Because even if you couldn't go to Jerusalem as a male, there was options for you to.
Right, the provisions to sell and then take the money, and that money became the offering. So we see corresponding all the way in Acts as well on the day of Pentecost, which based on the timeline we'll see probably were some people that were left over from Passover as well. It's not just excluded to males. I think I'm with you on that one. But the requirement was more that the male, the representation of the household, was supposed to go in to Jerusalem. So the second part of that question for the feast, which was kind of what was our correlation with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, was what's our correlation with the New Testament? Mike brought out the leaven that we removed. And so we have the unleavened bread in the Lord's Supper, the thing we see carrying over this purity of dough, the purity of the body. Any other correlations we want to draw between that? Mike?
Well, also during this, there's three... I don't say feast, because the only feast is unleavened bread, but three things that you had to do. Anyway, the third one was first fruits. The offering of the first fruits, which Jesus is the first fruit. He's the first of the new creation.
Right, and that happens, if I've got my timeline right, that actually happens right at the end of Passover, which then signifies the start of...
I thought it was the second day after.
Is it the second?
Bread.
That's right, because it's on Sunday. Because then this is what gives us our timeline for Pentecost, which is another one. You hear Pentecost 50 days, right? But then where does that counting come from? And we're going to see here that the Feast of Weeks is 7 weeks after, right? It's 49 days. 49 days after what? And it's after first fruits, which is where they have the waving of the grain, which would have been happened on the second day of unleavened bread. And then from there we have Pentecost. Thank you. The timelines can get a little tricky, especially as you read through these, and they all tend to use a different method of counting. Some will say days, some will say weeks, some will say the month and the day, or the previous day from another ceremony, and you're sitting there going, how am I supposed to keep this all straight? But thankfully, ours is a little easier today. We don't have quite the same ritual. So let's move on to that, the Feast of Weeks, which is also called Pentecost. So this happened at the first fruits, the counting of it starts at the first fruits, and then it happens 49 days after that. So 7 weeks, which is what we see, count 7 weeks from then. And this is then, what do they bring to the Lord at Pentecost? Because this is one of the three feasts. All three of the feasts, spoiler alert, are where the males come down. And at the end of the chapter, they're not supposed to be. They're not supposed to come empty-handed. So what do they bring here?
They bring a portion of what they had harvested. And it was in proportion to what they had harvested.
Yeah, so what is significant about that? What is the significance of at the... This isn't at the very beginning of harvest, because that's when first fruits is actually starts. But harvest has started, but not finished. Our last one, the Feast of Booths, is going to be at the end of the harvest. But we're early on in the harvest here. What would this represent? What would be the significance? If you can put your mind back in farming times. So if you don't have Kmart, you don't have Walmart. I guess I'm in Folsom, right? You don't have Whole Foods. How would that change us?
Well, part of it is that it shows a dependence that they have on God. They're not just looking at the crops they have. They're going to go ahead and do the sacrifices they're supposed to do, knowing that God will rather than.
Yeah. So modern day example is going to be if you can. Have you ever done any canning? We did this in Tennessee, and you stack up all your cans, and they go through the winter. And you're watching that stuff, and you're like, all right, I've got so many weeks left. If I eat one can every 2 days, I'm going to make it to here. And you're watching that, right? They don't have a grocery store to go to. And so at the beginning of the harvest, they harvest these things in, and they're getting ready to prepare them as the harvest continues to go on. And what are you going to want to do? You're going to want to eat the first stuff. Normally, it also tends to be a little bit better tasting. It's new. They're normally a little bit smaller, a little bit more tender. But all that aside, this is your provision that's going to sustain you after you might have actually ran out of food before the harvest has come. And you take, and I'm right with Will on this one, you show in your offering your dependence to God. There's a gratitude. Thank you for this land that you've given us. And from the produce, I'm going to give back to you. But then also, I'm not going to keep for myself first. I'm going to give to you first. So they don't know if it's going to be a bumper crop or not. They don't know if it's going to produce a lot this year. And out of that, they still have to take a portion, right? As opposed to giving of the leftovers to God. They give out of the only thing that's been provided from them from the start. So, again, this is also a free will offering. Where do we see our connection with Pentecost in the New Testament? Acts 2. Where did that came from? Allison, thank you. So Acts 2, the day of Pentecost, gives us a timeline. That was one that, realizing these timelines, the impact of Peter standing up in front of all of these people who have just crucified Jesus, right? 50 days before. We are less than 3 months in here. And he stands up and he says, you killed him. And you killed the Messiah. He makes some very bold statements in this short period of time. And then the response of the people. It also tells us why there were so many people in Jerusalem. Because they were supposed to be there for the festival. Do we have any significance? I did not find, I'll put this out here at first. I didn't find any, like, the Passover direct correlations. Maybe a little bit of a stretch is that we have Pentecost happens and we have this large influx into the church, right? This is the first fruits of Christians coming to the Lord. But we don't have any scriptural, actually, it's like supporting of that. But this is one that we just see, for me, God asking his people to come to him and depend out of their dependence on him and actually give an offering. Any comments on Pentecost? Great.
Personally, I tend to think of that, like the application for myself, the parallel would be like the contribution on Sundays and giving. I think for me, I see it when I'm like, when things are rough and I get like a paycheck and I'm like, already spending it in my mind and being like, oh no, I have to give this to God first, even though I like don't necessarily know how I'm paying the rest of my bills. Right? Like, and that's
yeah, so thinking, the attitude of thinking about your offering ahead of time as opposed to the leftovers, right? What you give to God. I think it's a great application point across this. And we can extend it from contribution, I think, even just to how we deal with previous chapter, the poor and the needy. Only helping people out of our abundance as opposed to helping people out of what we have. Because as Christians, we are taking care of our brothers and sisters and those who are in need, whether it be spiritually or physically. All right, last feast. Feast of Booths. So Feast of Booths, Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast Festival of Ingatherings. This is going to be at the end of the year, at the end of harvest, I should say. And it's the 15th day of the 7th month. And 7 days long, week-long festival here. And really, we've got two purposes for this. One is a thankfulness for the harvest. It's at the end of the harvest. They're coming and they're bringing an offering saying, thank you for what you've provided. What's the other purpose of the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, which is more directly tied to the name itself? Grant.
It's to remind them that they lived in tents or in booths during that time in the wilderness, and God protected them.
So during this time, they were to live in tents, live in booths. And so during this festival, it's looking back at where they came from. God wanted them to remember where they came from and the provisions that God had for them outside of the land itself. This one, we see it referenced in the New Testament. I don't think we get on this. The Passover, which is why I was okay on Sunday, we spent a lot more time on that, is the one that we've got a lot of correlation here. But out of all of these, we have this God asking his people to remember him and to bring offerings to him, constantly bringing an offering to him. Which then when we get to scriptures like Romans 12, where it talks about our spiritual lives being the worship and the sacrifice to God, I think it brings some weight into those statements, because we can get some tangible things looking back at the Old Testament and the requirements of God's people. The sacrifice and the worship that he desired was not from their leftovers, from their accidents. It wasn't something that just happened. It was something that was intentional, that they planned for, and that they used to show their dependence on God as well as their thankfulness for him. So I put up a little bit of a timeline up there. These are all things that directly come out of Deuteronomy chapter 16. I'll leave that up there for just a second. And then I want to move to a little bit of a break. So these chapters are broken up. And we come into this question 3, define justice and its importance in the life of a society. So let's start out first with, what is justice? The state of being just, okay. What does it mean to have justice within a society? Awesome.
Treating everyone equally or fairly.
Okay, I like that. Treating people fairly. So I'm going to ask you, because you are more of a wordsmith than I am. with equally, is that applying positively? So fairly, right, seems to be a positive application. Equally, you could treat everyone equally bad, but we still consider that justice.
Probably not. But like fair, there's different definitions of fairness too, because sometimes fairness is treating everyone the same. And sometimes fairness is like treating everyone as an individual. So not always the same thing.
Where's the tricky?
Equity and equality, it's kind of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have a let me break this down a little bit. We have the application of a standard across a set of people. And we would then, I think, consider that fair, right? So with justice, there are punishments, right, as well as rewards, potentially, based on a known standard. I mean, it's across a group of people. I think it's a big thing with justice, is we're normally talking about applying this across more than a single person, but to a group of people. Aaron?
I think a step back from the fairness would just be an accountability to a standard. Holding people accountable to a standard.
Okay, so just to bring out the different parts here too, as we're going, talking through this, we've got subjects, we've got potentially people to enforce it, because what's the use of having a set of law without an enforcement, or there's no authority behind that, and then the law and the power behind that law. Grant?
Yeah, I mean, in this section, verses 18 through 20, speaking specifically of, you know, justice in the courts, the point of judges who will be just, which means giving people equal treatment under the law, and in this case it's the law of God that he's given them. And he defines it in verse 19 by defining perversion of justice, and gives them two examples. You shall not show partiality, and you shall not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise. So you're not to just treat one party differently than the other, either because you identify with one more than the other, or you like one more than the other, or somebody has paid you to treat somebody differently. They're supposed to be treated equally under the law, the same rights, you know, as the other.
Right, so at that point, we've got the removal of rights, either the right to a penalty or the right to a reward under the law, based on skewing of the person doing the judging. So in my attempt to this, we'll come right back to you, Mike, the quality of being fair and reasonable, and then the administration of the law or authority in maintaining this or maintaining the law. So bringing in all the parts with justice, there's got to be some standard there for justice. Because if not, then justice becomes something that is subjective. And it's hard to then say that justice itself, it's kind of like when you're talking about truth. And if there's no standard to truth, there really is no such thing as truth, because it's whatever you feel. Justice being the same way. If you take justice in the sense of removing out some external standard, justice just becomes whatever I think is fair and reasonable, which could actually not be justice to someone else. And so at that point, right, for justice to be applied to a society means that there needs to be the law and the administration of that law outside of the society itself. Mike?
That's what I was going to bring up. In order to have justice, you have to have rules or regulations in order to have justice. And if you're assuming with the rule of law, whoever's going to apply that, your administration or authority would do it with justice. But you have to have the law first.
Yes, you have the law, and then you have to have the authority for that justice to be carried out. Great.
I was just thinking, this conversation makes me think about how justice can feel like unjust, so like sometimes it doesn't feel balanced, right? Because you're pulling, it's essentially you're righting wrongs, right? So there's a lot of emotion there, and there's a lot of those things are hard to quantify, like how do you distribute justice? And last week I was listening to somebody talk about people like to compare the Code of Hammurabi to the Old Testament law, because the oldest law we have by mankind. And it's really interesting, one of the contrasts they pulled out is that in God's law, he wrongs done against people in a physical way are repaid in a physical way. Whereas like in Hammurabi's law, it's like if somebody gets killed, you give them money or like property or something like that. And so it was just interesting to me, does God's justice become different that looks than our justice?
As you're saying that, the other thing that I'm thinking, with justice here that has to be, because I'm looking at justice applied to a society, which is really the next question here, is the importance of justice in a society or on a society, is those things of justice, the righting of the wrong, they have to be not agreed upon by the people, but that's the standard that's set on the people as this is considered full repayment for the thing that was done wrong. Which again just speaks to where that comes from. I mean, who gets the power to set what's just and what is not just. So what is the importance of it? Right. So we brought out that it gives us the ability to right wrongs. If there was no justice, Nita. Okay, and I think another way to say that is a phrase that we've seen in Deuteronomy is that they would do what was right in their own eyes, right? Without justice, which means there would be no, right? We'd have a missing link of our authority, of our law, of our enforcement. People would just do what was right in their own eyes. And then with that, God brings in here then the perversion of justice, which is what Grant brought out today. And for them it was perverted. He brings out some specific things. He says you're going to get some people that are going to be put in power. And with that power is going to come some external forces that are going to try to have them pervert justice. So take what's due them and change it by them applying some money. Which is really saying that they're going to take the law and the authority of the law and submit to someone else. Is the big thing here, I think, with justice in God's society is this is actually a form of perversion towards idolatry. If we look at idolatry as going away from God and his standard, when someone accepts a bribe and perverts justice, and that justice is based on the law of God, you are accepting an authority outside of God's standard. And in this case, even putting yourself above what that application is. Right? God lays out what is right and what is wrong so that imperfect man is not deciding that. But you then take it upon yourself to say, well, someone paid me some money, so I'm going to give them a different ruling. I'm going to make a judgment outside of God's judgment. So pulling into this then, how is justice perverted today? Or this concept of justice coming across in, let's talk about in the church itself today. Do we have a similar concept of justice? So we don't necessarily have the court of the Israelites that we apply to here today that we're looking to get our things solved. But where does justice play in our lives today? How is it perverted? Aaron?
I think it's different now in that God is not directly interacting with us like he was with the Israelites. And also his justice was their law. We have God's law that we follow, and we also have other laws that we follow. And when we break other laws that we're supposed to follow, we do go to court or, you know, whatever for that. But when we break God's laws, we don't. So there's a delayed justice, so to speak, I guess. And so it can be more difficult, I think, to hold yourself accountable, you know, because of that.
Yeah, so when we look at the righting of that wrong and the justice, I think in your case we're talking about us sinning, and the just what's due us, it's not something physical. And so there can be the mindset to pervert the justice that God is going to have by putting that off, right? Saying that this sin doesn't matter, there's no consequence for it. And from the personal application standpoint. What about from justice in terms of, let's keep going with that, with sin. Justice with sin. What are ways that justice is perverted today? And this is, I think, a little bit harder to think about because of what Aaron said. It's God carrying out this justice. But are there ways that man perverts that justice today? Al?
I think by reinterpreting the Bible, reinterpreting God's law, God's plan. Not doing that.
Yeah, so that's the way that we see in the Old Testament here, let's point out in Deuteronomy, is perversion is through those who are applying justice. What you brought up, which is where my mind is also, is this concept of changing what that authority is, changing what the law is, and so then at that point, justice is served because of how I interpret the law. As opposed to, we know that God is a just judge, and he's a righteous judge, and so the judgments he pronounces are going to be based on what we've been given. But when we take and make the law for our Christian walk and the requirements that God has for us something that's up to our own subjection, we have perverted justice. We've perverted what God has put out there for us. And God does not stand for this. And that's what I get from this section here, is this perversion of justice is not something that the Lord is going to just wash over. And we see what happens to the priests, to Eli's sons, right? Because of their perversion of justice and how God takes and wipes them out. And those who try to take and make their own ruling or make their own laws outside of what God has. All right. The end of chapter 16, we do with idolatry. I like David's question here on this. Do we have application for this today? So this is 16, 21 and 22. You shall not plant any trees as an Asherah beside the altar of the Lord your God that you make. You shall not set up a pillar which the Lord your God hates. Let's just jump straight to it. Is there an application here for this?
How? I think any idol-like thing. Fame or whatever that we put before God is the same as planting a pole next to the Lord's temple.
Okay, so the just the general application of we should have no idols today, right, Aaron?
I mean, these are very specific things that he called out. I'm not sure what God had against pillars, but I would imagine that during that time there were lots of pillars being erected around, you know, other shrines or whatever. So I think God kind of is specifically pointing out maybe two things that might have been very popular at the time. And in that sense, the modern-day application is, you know, when things get popular or whatever, you know, God knows what he wants, and it's not up to us to let other outside influences come into how God wants to be worshipped.
Yeah, so I think this is specific for a reason. Previously, he's already said, don't worship idols. But he calls out the asteroid. He calls out these things that are prominent in Canaan pagan culture. And I think he's saying, don't try to mix your worship to God with these signs that you see from these other people. Not necessarily, don't just go all the way over to idolatry, but don't try to mix in the cultures together. There's no place for worship with God and something that looks like worship to a Baal in God's worship. And so looking at then from an application here is not pulling in other forms of worship into our worship to God. Looking for other things to define what it means to have a relationship with God, to worship God, and taking away from the simplicity of the gospel and the worship that we have today. I think we have the same similar concept of looking at what it tells us about God, that God requires his worship and his people to be purely and wholly devoted to him. Dave?
I think this could also be, I mean, obviously the Asherah is a reference to the type of God at the time, but pillar is very generic, right? And so I think it could also just be pointing out the fact that he doesn't want any substitutions for what he's asked for, right? Because someone could say, oh, I made this pillar because we can't see you, and I want to have this just to represent you, right? And I think just in today's society, there are lots of these types of things where we see alternative forms of worship because it's easier or helps people visualize better or something else. And I think that might be an application.
Yeah, absolutely. That's back to Exodus 34, where they set up the calf. That this was the Lord your God that brought you out of Egypt. They wanted something tangible that they could look at and call a physical God. And God specifically says, that's not what I want. Don't take the form of worship that man has created to make a physical thing, because I am not the physical God like they are. So our last section here is sacrifice, Deuteronomy 17, and looking at then the requirements of sacrifice. So requirements of sacrifice for Passover, right? We have the lamb. What was significant about the lamb? Why did that matter? So what had to be called out for the lamb for it to be qualified, and then why was that important? Allison?
There had to be no blemish or defect, so it had to be perfect. And then, to me, it's kind of two things. It shows, by giving that, it shows honor to God, like you are due the best. And then, maybe we've talked about that already, but for sure we talked about this today. And also the dependence, like Will said, on God, that I'm giving you my best, but what I have left over will be enough for me. So like the faith, the honor and faith aspects.
Yeah, I don't think we've talked too much about the honor, but we talked a little bit about the giving, about bringing to God first. But I do think that honoring God with the best of what you have, the importance and the value that you place on God is worth the most valuable and important thing that you have, which a male of your flock, that's the best looking one, is going to be the one that you use to breed your flock going forward. So you are saying, I am not going to rely on my physical ability to make my stuff the best that I can, but God, I'm going to honor you and give you that best. So, New Testament equivalent. Has the requirement changed? Do we even have a correlation for requirements for this? Because we don't offer lambs. Mike?
Well, if you think about Romans 12, we offer ourselves, and it should be the best part of us, and that fully, completely, but it's that life that we have that we're offering God, that life. He is perfect.
Yeah, that's it. I think that even comes back to the conversation we had a couple weeks ago, that perfection. While we are spotted and blemished, we have sin, and we still strive for that perfection, to honor God in the perfection of the life, and knowing that we can, and through Jesus, right, we can look perfect to God. I mean, that is still what he desires for his people. And then coming back then to Jesus, the requirement for the release, for the freedom, right, was the firstborn son or that lamb. Coming all the way back to that. So that lamb that gave its place so that the Israelites could be rescued. Not that it had any special physical properties, but that's what God required of them. The same righteous requirement of the law is shown in Jesus with his perfection coming and offering himself. And so we still have that for our freedom from sin to be released. We still had to have this perfect, spotless lamb. Okay?
I'm sorry, you got too far ahead. I was trying to stop.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
If I go back to Aaron's question in chapter 16, 22.
Yes.
The tree, the pillar, and she said, I don't know what the difference is. To this day, in Africa, people worship trees because the trees are so huge and they're so magnificent. Outside of the capital of Ethiopia, they took us to a place where they have an altar where this magnificent tree is the size of this room or bigger, and they worship. The difference in verse 22, when God says, I hate pillars, he doesn't say that about trees. And the reason is, he grows the tree. So when the people plant the tree, it is an affront to God when they plant the tree and it becomes huge and they give it a pagan name. That's bad enough. But then when they themselves create a pillar of stone and say, that's God. What that text is saying, that's what God despises. He rejects the tree, but he despises, hates anything that is man-made. And that's the answer to Aaron's question. I tried to catch all of it on it. Just said, I need that before the bell.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's good to see those distinctions and know the distinctions there. But I definitely did not know that at all. And you do focus on the worship of the man-made worship, which is what God hates. But then coming from even from the trees. It's good. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm sorry for missing you. So we've got 10 seconds, so we're not going to go the last question there with punishment and capital punishment. But just looking with that, right, we see people did not die with on the account of one. Same requirement that we have today of you take multiple people, right? You confront your brother, you go with another person, then you take it before the eldership. There is a process to the justice and the requirements that God has for the law among his people. So we will start with page 18 on Sunday. Thank you.